Hey, then we will do more than threaten, ATM said the knights. And they went out with the 12 men, and put on their armor, and drew their shining swords, and came back. His servants, in the meantime, had shut up and barred the great gate of the palace. At first, the knights tried to shatter it with their battle axes, but, being shown a window by which they could enter, they let the gate alone, and climbed in that way. While they were battering at the door, the attendants of Thomas A. Tilda Becket had implored him to take refuge in the cathedral, in which, as a sanctuary or sacred place, they thought the knights would dare to do no violent deed. He told them, again and again, that he would not stir. Hearing the distant voices of the monks singing the evening service, however, he said it was now his duty to attend, and therefore, and for no other reason, he would go. There was an earway between his palace and the cathedral, by some beautiful old cloisters which you may yet see. He went into the cathedral, without any hurry, and having the cross carried before him as usual. When he was safely there, his servants would have fastened the door, but he said no. It was the house of God and not a fortress. As he spoke, the shadow of Reginald Fitzurse appeared in the cathedral doorway, darkening the little light there was outside, on the dark winter evening. This knight said, in a strong voice, "Ay, follow me, loyal servants of the king." ATM The rattle of the armor of the other knights echoed through the cathedral, as they came clashing in. It was so dark, in the lofty aisles and among the stately pillars of the church, and there were so many hiding places in the crypt below and in the narrow passages above, that Thomas A. Tilda Becket might even at that pass have saved himself if he would. But he would not. He told the monks resolutely that he would not. And though they all dispersed and left him there with no other follower than Edward Grime, his faithful cross-bearer, he was as firm then, as ever he had been in his life. The knights came on, through the darkness, making a terrible noise with their armed tread upon the stone pavement of the church. "Eh, where is the traitor?" "ATM," they cried out. He made no answer. But when they cried, "Eh, where is the archbishop?" "ATM," he said proudly, "eh, I am here." "ATM," and came out of the shade and stood before them. The knights had no desire to kill him, if they could rid the king and themselves of him by any other means. They told him he must either fly or go with them. He said he would do neither, and he threw William Tracy off with such force when he took hold of his sleeve, that Tracy reeled again. By his reproaches and his steadiness, he so incensed them, and exasperated their fierce humour, that Reginald Fitzurse, whom he called by an ill name, said, "Ay, then die." ATM and struck at his head. But the faithful Edward Grime put out his arm, and there received the main force of the blow, so that it only made his master bleed. Another voice from among the knights again called to Thomas A. Tilda Becket to fly, but, with his blood running down his face, and his hands clasped, and his head bent, he commanded himself to God, and stood firm. Then they cruelly killed him close to the altar of St. Bennet, and his body fell upon the pavement, which was dirtied with his blood and brains. It is an awful thing to think of the murdered mortal, who had so showered his curses about, lying, all disfigured, in the church, where a few lamps here and there were but red specks on a pall of darkness, and to think of the guilty knights riding away on horseback, looking over their shoulders at the dim cathedral, and remembering what they had left inside. Part the second. When the king heard how Thomas A. Tilda Becket had lost his life in Canterbury Cathedral, through the ferocity of the four knights, he was filled with dismay. Some have supposed that when the king spoke those hasty words, "Eh, have I no one here who will deliver me from this man?" ATM he wished, and meant A. Tilda Becket to be slain. But few things are more unlikely, for, besides that the king was not naturally cruel, though very passionate, he was wise, and must have known full well what any stupid man in his dominions must have known, namely, that such a murder would rouse the Pope and the whole church against him. He sent respectful messengers to the Pope, to represent his innocence, except in having uttered the hasty words, and he swore solemnly and publicly to his innocence, and contrived in time to make his peace. As to the four guilty knights, who fled into Yorkshire, and never again dared to show themselves at court. The Pope excommunicated them, and they lived miserably for some time, shunned by all their countrymen. At last, they went humbly to Jerusalem as a penance, and there died and were buried. It happened, fortunately for the pacifying of the Pope, that an opportunity arose very soon after the murder of Matilda Becket, for the king to declare his power in Ireland, which was an acceptable undertaking to the Pope, as the Irish, who had been converted to Christianity by one Patricius, otherwise Saint Patrick, long ago, before any Pope existed, considered that the Pope had nothing at all to do with them, or they with the Pope, and accordingly refused to pay him Peter at Tiamespence, or that tax of a penny a house which I have elsewhere mentioned. The king of Tiames' opportunity arose in this way. The Irish were, at that time, as barbarous a people as you can well imagine. They were continually quarrelling and fighting, cutting one another at Tiamese throats, slicing one another at Tiamese noses, burning one another at Tiamese houses, carrying away one another at Tiamese wives, and committing all sorts of violence. The country was divided into five kingdoms: Desmond, Dermond, Connaught, Ulster, and Leinster, each governed by a separate king, of whom one claimed to be the chief of the rest. Now, one of these kings, named Dermond MacMurrough, a wild kind of name, spelt in more than one wild kind of way, had carried off the wife of a friend of his, and concealed her on an island in a bog. The friend, resenting this, though it was quite the custom of the country, complained to the chief king, and, with the chief king of Tiamese help, drove Dermond MacMurrough out of his dominions. Dermond came over to England for revenge, and offered to hold his realm as a vassal of King Henry, if King Henry would help him to regain it. The king consented to these terms, but only assisted him, then, with what were called letters patent, authorizing any English subjects who were so disposed, to enter into his service, and aid his cause. There was, at Bristol, a certain Earl Richard de Clare, called Strongbow, of no very good character, needy and desperate, and ready for anything that offered him a chance of improving his fortunes. There were, in South Wales, two other broken knights of the same good-for-nothing sort, called Robert Fitzstephen, and Maurice Fitzgerald. These three, each with a small band of followers, took up Dermond at Tiamese cause, and it was agreed that if it proved successful, Strongbow should marry Dermond at Tiamese daughter Eva, and be declared his heir. The trained English followers of these knights were so superior in all the discipline of battle to the Irish, that they beat them against immense superiority of numbers. In one fight, early in the war, they cut off 300 heads, and laid them before MacMurrough, who turned them every one up with his hands, rejoicing, and, coming to one which was the head of a man whom he had much disliked, grasped it by the hair and ears, and tore off the nose and lips with his teeth. You may judge from this, what kind of a gentleman an Irish king in those times was. The captives, all through this war, were horribly treated, the victorious party making nothing of breaking their limbs, and casting them into the sea from the tops of high rocks. It was in the midst of the miseries and cruelties attendant on the taking of Waterford, where the dead lay piled in the streets, and the filthy gutters ran with blood, that Strongbow married Eva. An odious marriage company those mounds of corpse Tiamese must have made, I think, and one quite worthy of the young lady Tiamese father. He died, after Waterford and Dublin had been taken, and various successes achieved, and Strongbow became king of Leinster. Now came King Henry at Tiamese opportunity. To restrain the growing power of Strongbow, he himself repaired to Dublin, as Strongbow at Tiamese royal master, and deprived him of his kingdom, but confirmed him in the enjoyment of great possessions. The king, then, holding state in Dublin, received the homage of nearly all the Irish kings and chiefs, and so came home again with a great addition to his reputation as Lord of Ireland, and with a new claim on the favour of the Pope. And now, their reconciliation was completed more easily and mildly by the Pope, than the king might have expected, I think. At this period of his reign, when his troubles seemed so few and his prospects so bright, those domestic miseries began which gradually made the king the most unhappy of men, reduced his great spirit, wore away his health, and broke his heart. He had four sons. Henry, now aged 18, a his secret crowning of whom had given such offence to Thomas A. Tilda Becket. Richard, aged 16, Geoffrey, 15, and John, his favourite, a young boy whom the courtiers named Lackland, because he had no inheritance, but to whom the king meant to give the lordship of Ireland. All these misguided boys, in their turn, were unnatural sons to him, and unnatural brothers to each other. Prince Henry, stimulated by the French king, and by his bad mother, Queen Eleanor, began the undutiful history. First, he demanded that his young wife, Margaret, the French king Otiam's daughter, should be crowned as well as he. His father, the king, consented, and it was done. It was no sooner done than he demanded to have a part of his father Otiam's dominions, during his father Otiam's life. This being refused, he made off from his father in the night, with his bad heart full of bitterness, and took refuge at the French king Otiam's court. Within a day or two, his brothers Richard and Geoffrey followed. Their mother tried to join them escaping in Manatiam's clothes, but she was seized by King Henry Otiam's men, and immured in prison, where she lay, deservedly, for 16 years. Every day, however, some grasping English nobleman, to whom the king Otiam's protection of his people from their avarice and oppression had given offence, deserted him and joined the princes. Every day he heard some fresh intelligence of the princes levying armies against him, of Prince Henry Otiam's wearing a crown before his own ambassadors at the French court, and being called the junior king of England, of all the princes swearing never to make peace with him, their father, without the consent and approval of the barons of France. But, with his fortitude and energy unshaken, King Henry met the shock of these disasters with a resolved and cheerful face. He called upon all royal fathers who had sons, to help him, for his cause was theirs. He hired, out of his riches, 20,000 men to fight the false French king, who stirred his own blood against him, and he carried on the war with such vigor, that Louis soon proposed a conference to treat for peace. The conference was held beneath an old wide-spreading green elm tree, upon a plain in France. It led to nothing. The war recommenced. Prince Richard began his fighting career, by leading an army against his father, but his father beat him and his army back, and thousands of his men would have rued the day in which they fought in such a wicked cause, had not the king received news of an invasion of England by the Scots, and promptly come home through a great storm to repress it. And whether he really began to fear that he suffered these troubles because Tilda Becket had been murdered, or whether he wished to rise in the favour of the Pope, who had now declared Tilda Becket to be a saint, or in the favour of his own people, of whom many believed that even Tilda Becket at Tiam's senseless tomb could work miracles, I don't yet know. But the king no sooner landed in England than he went straight to Canterbury, and when he came within sight of the distant cathedral, he dismounted from his horse, took off his shoes, and walked with bare and bleeding feet to Tilda Becket at Tiam's grave. There, he lay down on the ground, lamenting, in the presence of many people, and by he went into the chapter house, and, removing his clothes from his back and shoulders, submitted himself to be beaten with knotted cords, not beaten very hard, I dare say though, by 80 priests, one after another. It chanced that on the very day when the king made this curious exhibition of himself, a complete victory was obtained over the Scots, which very much delighted the priests, who said that it was won because of his great example of repentance. For the priests in general had found out, since Tilda Becket at Tiam's death, that they admired him of all things, though they had hated him very cordially when he was alive. The Earl of Flanders, who was at the head of the base conspiracy of the king Otiam's undutiful sons and their foreign friends, took the opportunity of the king being thus employed at home, to lay siege to Rouen, the capital of Normandy. But the king, who was extraordinarily quick and active in all his movements, was at Rouen, too, before it was supposed possible that he could have left England, and there he so defeated the said Earl of Flanders, that the conspirators proposed peace, and his bad sons Henry and Geoffrey submitted. Richard resisted for 6 weeks, but, being beaten out of castle after castle, he at last submitted too, and his father forgave him. To forgive these unworthy princes was only to afford them breathing time for new faithlessness. They were so false, disloyal, and dishonorable, that they were no more to be trusted than common thieves. In the very next year, Prince Henry rebelled again, and was again forgiven. In 8 years more, Prince Richard rebelled against his elder brother, and Prince Geoffrey infamously said that the brothers could never agree well together, unless they were united against their father. In the very next year after their reconciliation by the king, Prince Henry again rebelled against his father, and again submitted, swearing to be true, and was again forgiven, and again rebelled with Geoffrey. But the end of this perfidious prince was come. He fell sick at a French town, and his conscience terribly reproaching him with his baseness, he sent messengers to the king his father, imploring him to come and see him, and to forgive him for the last time on his bed of death. The generous king, who had a royal and forgiving mind towards his children always, would have gone, but this prince had been so unnatural, that the nobleman about the king suspected treachery, and represented to him that he could not safely trust his life with such a traitor, though his own eldest son. Therefore the king sent him a ring from off his finger as a token of forgiveness, and when the prince had kissed it, with much grief and many tears, and had confessed to those around him how bad, and wicked, and undutiful a son he had been, he said to the attendant priests, "Ao, tie a rope about my body, and draw me out of bed, and lay me down upon a bed of ashes, that I may die with prayers to God in a repentant manner." And so he died, at 27 years old. 3 years afterwards, Prince Geoffrey, being unhorsed at a tournament, had his brains trampled out by a crowd of horses passing over him. So, there only remained Prince Richard, and Prince John, who had grown to be a young man now, and had solemnly sworn to be faithful to his father. Richard soon rebelled again, encouraged by his friend the French king, Philip II, son of Louis, who was dead, and soon submitted and was again forgiven, swearing on a New Testament never to rebel again, and in another year or so, rebelled again, and, in the presence of his father, knelt down on his knee before the King of France, and did the French king homage, and declared that with his aid he would possess himself, by force, of all his father at Etienne's French dominions. And yet this Richard called himself a soldier of our Saviour. And yet this Richard wore the cross, which the kings of France and England had both taken, in the previous year, at a brotherly meeting underneath the old wide-spreading elm tree on the plain, when they had sworn, like him, to devote themselves to a new crusade, for the love and honor of the truth. Sick at heart, wearied out by the falsehood of his sons, and almost ready to lie down and die, the unhappy king who had so long stood firm, began to fail. But the Pope, to his honor, supported him, and obliged the French king and Richard, though successful in fight, to treat for peace. Richard wanted to be crowned King of England, and pretended that he wanted to be married, which he really did not, to the French king Etienne's sister, his promised wife, whom King Henry detained in England. King Henry wanted, on the other hand, that the French king Etienne's sister should be married to his favorite son, John, the only one of his sons, he said, who had never rebelled against him. At last King Henry, deserted by his nobles one by one, distressed, exhausted, broken-hearted, consented to establish peace. One final heavy sorrow was reserved for him, even yet. When they brought him the proposed treaty of peace, in writing, as he lay very ill in bed, they brought him also the list of the deserters from their allegiance, whom he was required to pardon. The first name upon this list was John, his favorite son, in whom he had trusted to the last. "Ao, John, child of my heart." exclaimed the king, in a great agony of mind. "Ao, John, whom I have loved the best. Oh, John, for whom I have contended through these many troubles. Have you betrayed me too? ATM And then he lay down with a heavy groan, and said, Ay, now let the world go as it will. I care for nothing more. ATM After a time, he told his attendants to take him to the French town of Chinona, a town he had been fond of, during many years. But he was fond of no place now, it was too true that he could care for nothing more upon this earth. He wildly cursed the hour when he was born, and cursed the children whom he left behind him, and expired. As, 100 years before, the servile followers of the court had abandoned the conqueror in the hour of his death, so they now abandoned his descendant. The very body was stripped, in the plunder of the royal chamber, and it was not easy to find the means of carrying it for burial to the abbey church of Fontevraud. Richard was said in after years, by way of flattery, to have the heart of a lion. It would have been far better, I think, to have had the heart of a man. His heart, whatever it was, had cause to beat remorsefully within his breast, when he came as he did there into the solemn abbey, and looked on his dead father at EMS uncovered face. His heart, whatever it was, had been a black and perjured heart, in all its dealings with the deceased king, and more deficient in a single touch of tenderness than any wild beast at EMS in the forest. There is a pretty story told of this reign, called the story of Fair Rosamond. It relates how the king doted on Fair Rosamond, who was the loveliest girl in all the world, and how he had a beautiful bower built for her in a park at Woodstock, and how it was erected in a labyrinth, and could only be found by a clue of silk. How the bad Queen Eleanor, becoming jealous of Fair Rosamond, found out the secret of the clue, and one day, appeared before her, with a dagger and a cup of poison, and left her to the choice between those deaths. How Fair Rosamond, after shedding many piteous tears and offering many useless prayers to the cruel queen, took the poison, and fell dead in the midst of the beautiful bower, while the unconscious birds sang gaily all around her. Now, there was a Fair Rosamond, and she was, I dare say, the loveliest girl in all the world, and the king was certainly very fond of her, and the bad Queen Eleanor was certainly made jealous. But I am afraid, I say afraid, because I like the story so much that there was no bower, no labyrinth, no silken clue, no dagger, no poison. I am afraid Fair Rosamond retired to a nunnery near Oxford, and died there, peaceably, her sister nuns hanging a silken drapery over her tomb, and often dressing it with flowers, in remembrance of the youth and beauty that had enchanted the king when he too was young, and when his life lay fair before him. It was dark and ended now, faded and gone. Henry Plantagenet lay quiet in the abbey church of Fontevraud, in the 57th year of his Aegean, never to be completed, oh, after governing England well, for nearly 35 years. Chapter XIII. England under Richard I, called the Lion Heart, in the year of our Lord 1189, Richard of the Lion Heart succeeded to the throne of King Henry II, whose paternal heart he had done so much to break. He had been, as we have seen, a rebel from his boyhood, but, the moment he became a king against whom others might rebel, he found out that rebellion was a great wickedness. In the heat of this pious discovery, he punished all the leading people who had befriended him against his father. He could scarcely have done anything that would have been a better instance of his real nature, or a better warning to fawners and parasites not to trust in lion-hearted princes. He likewise put his late father at EMS treasurer in chains, and locked him up in a dungeon from which he was not set free until he had relinquished, not only all the crown treasure, but all his own money too. So, Richard certainly got the lion at EMS share of the wealth of this wretched treasurer, whether he had a lion at EMS heart or not. He was crowned King of England, with great pomp, at Westminster, walking to the cathedral under a silken canopy stretched on the tops of 4 lances, each carried by a great lord. On the day of his coronation, a dreadful murdering of the Jews took place, which seems to have given great delight to numbers of savage persons calling themselves Christians. The king had issued a proclamation forbidding the Jews, who were generally hated, though they were the most useful merchants in England, to appear at the ceremony, but as they had assembled in London from all parts, bringing presents to show their respect for the new sovereign, some of them ventured down to Westminster Hall with their gifts, which were very readily accepted. It is supposed, now, that some noisy fellow in the crowd, pretending to be a very delicate Christian, set up a howl at this, and struck a Jew who was trying to get in at the hall door with his present. A riot arose. The Jews who had got into the hall were driven forth, and some of the rabble cried out that the new king had commanded the unbelieving race to be put to death. Thereupon the crowd rushed through the narrow streets of the city, slaughtering all the Jews they met, and when they could find no more out of doors, on account of their having fled to their houses, and fastened themselves in, they ran madly about, breaking open all the houses where the Jews lived, rushing in and stabbing or spearing them, sometimes even flinging old people and children out of window into blazing fires they had lighted up below. This great cruelty lasted 24 hours, and only 3 men were punished for it. Even they forfeited their lives not for murdering and robbing the Jews, but for burning the houses of some Christians. King Richard, who was a strong, restless, burly man, with one idea always in his head, and that the very troublesome idea of breaking the heads of other men, was mightily impatient to go on a crusade to the Holy Land, with a great army. As great armies could not be raised to go, even to the Holy Land, without a great deal of money, he sold the crown domains, and even the high offices of state, recklessly appointing noblemen to rule over his English subjects, not because they were fit to govern, but because they could pay high for the privilege. In this way, and by selling pardons at a dear rate and by varieties of avarice and oppression, he scraped together a large treasure. He then appointed 2 bishops to take care of his kingdom in his absence, and gave great powers and possessions to his brother John, to secure his friendship. John would rather have been made regent of England, but he was a sly man, and friendly to the expedition, saying to himself, "No doubt, the more fighting, the more chance of my brother being killed, and when he is killed, then I become King John." Before the newly levied army departed from England, the recruits and the general populace distinguished themselves by astonishing cruelties on the unfortunate Jews, whom, in many large towns, they murdered by hundreds in the most horrible manner. At York, a large body of Jews took refuge in the castle, in the absence of its governor, after the wives and children of many of them had been slain before their eyes. Presently came the governor, and demanded admission. "How can we give it thee, O governor?" said the Jews upon the walls, "When, if we open the gate by so much as the width of a foot, the roaring crowd behind thee will press in and kill us?" Upon this, the unjust governor became angry, and told the people that he approved of their killing those Jews, and a mischievous maniac of a friar, dressed all in white, put himself at the head of the assault, and they assaulted the castle for 3 days. Then said Joson, the head Jew, who is a rabbi or priest, to the rest, brethren, there is no hope for us with the Christians who are hammering at the gates and walls, and who must soon break in, as we and our wives and children must die, either by Christian hands, or by our own. Let it be by our own. Let us destroy by fire what jewels and other treasure we have here, then fire the castle, and then perish." A few could not resolve to do this, but the greater part complied. They made a blazing heap of all their valuables, and, when those were consumed, set the castle in flames. While the flames roared and crackled around them, and shooting up into the sky, turned it blood red, Joson cut the throat of his beloved wife, and stabbed himself. All the others who had wives or children, did the like dreadful deed. When the populace broke in, they found, except the trembling few, cowering in corners, whom they soon killed, only heaps of greasy cinders, with here and there something like part of the blackened trunk of a burnt tree, but which had lately been a human creature, formed by the beneficent hand of the Creator as they were. After this bad beginning, Richard and his troops went on, in no very good manner, with the Holy Crusade. It was undertaken jointly by the King of England and his old friend Philip of France. They commenced the business by reviewing their forces, to the number of 100,000 men. Afterwards, they severally embarked their troops for Messina, in Sicily, which was appointed as the next place of meeting.